From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump seemed to reverse himself on that bipartisan short-term plan to help insurance companies cover low-income people, which came late yesterday. Yesterday, the president told reporters he thought the plan from the Republican Lamar Alexander and the Democrat Patty Murray could be a solution for about 1 or 2 years. Last night, he spoke before the Conservative Heritage Foundation and rolled that back.
While I commend the bipartisan work done by Senators Alexander and Murray, and I do commend it, I continue to believe Congress must find a solution to the Obamacare mess instead of providing bailouts to insurance companies.
And this morning, the president tweeted that I am supportive of Lamar as a person and also of the process, but I can never support bailing out insurance companies who have made a fortune with OCARE, Obamacare. Well, joining us for this and other political stories, and there are many, NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
Well, and today, Speaker Ryan's spokesperson also emailed that Ryan might not support this, again, short-term bipartisan plan, but focus instead on repeal and replace. What's going on here? The president initially said it could be a solution.
It's a very tricky thing politically for the conservative base. It's not something that the conservative base would like at all. I think what you might be seeing here is President Trump trying to do some kind of a, you know, marketing slash branding technique where you continue to hammer over and over again the saying that, you know, we're not going to bail out insurance companies because bailouts and insurance companies are the two things that probably have worse favorability ratings than, you know, frankly, us in the media, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, this does not necessarily mean, I don't think, that he's saying let's kill the Alexander Murray, you know, potential solution. And one thing that we should pay close attention to once we see language come out of what the bill actually says is whether or not this bill says that it makes it clear that the subsidies must be spent toward premium costs. So you could write into the legislation to say, you know, the money that goes to the insurance companies has to be spent on reducing premiums. And we got a clue that that may in fact be what's in this legislation because Senator Alexander tweeted this morning, the Alexander Murray agreement has strong language to do that. And I will work with the president to see if we can make it stronger. And he said he and I absolutely agree that CSRs, these cost sharing reductions, well, these subsidy payments, should benefit consumers and not insurance companies.
It also might be that Senator Murray, in speaking yesterday, attached to her comments that this might be a solution, I'm paraphrasing here, but because of those sabotaging Obamacare. And we know that the president reacts to that kind of language. So
right,
perhaps something there happened. But let's move to his escalation and his war of words with Senator McCain. In a radio interview on the Chris Plant Show, Donald Trump warned the senator that at some point I fight back. This was after McCain pretty much excoriated what he called a half-baked, spurious nationalism over the weekend. He did not mention President Trump, but seemed to be referring to his policies. After Trump said today he would escalate, perhaps fight back, McCain caught in a hall, shrugged it off, and said, I've faced far greater challenges.
Yep.
Domenico, this is a man who was a hostage and is fighting cancer. Why would President Trump do this?
Oh, why? Well, I don't know if I can get into the head of President Trump. I think that, but I do think that the consistency with President Trump is that he, anytime he feels like there's a personal attack, he needs to fight back and hit back harder. That's been an organizing principle for his entire life. But the thing is, what I find fascinating here when he says, at some point I fight back, well, he had already attacked John McCain in probably the harshest way he possibly could back in 2015 when he said, he's not a war hero. I prefer people who weren't captured. And to which Corey Lewandowski, his campaign manager at the time, said later that he thought that that was the end of the campaign. So, you know, I don't know what else he could possibly say about John McCain that would be harsher than that, but I'm sure he'll come up with something.
We just have a minute here. Attorney General Jeff Sessions took questions today from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Anything new here? This is in the investigation into Russian connections to the election.
Well, Sessions was very careful to say that his communications with the president, whatever they were when it came to the firing of James Comey, the former FBI director, he wouldn't talk about it. He wouldn't even confirm whether or not there were any conversations that took place. Obviously, a very tricky legal line that he's trying to walk there.
Okay, so we'll pay attention to that. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, always busy weeks, and this is another one. Domenico, thank you.
It's always entertaining. You're welcome.
Well, the Dow Jones Industrial Average opened today at another record high after hitting 23,000 for the first time yesterday. The Dow is up more than 25% since the election, and it has more than tripled since the market hit bottom just after President Obama took office. Joining us now is Diane Swonk, founder of DS Economics. She's in Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Good to be here.
And another milestone for the Dow. We know President Trump would love to take credit for it, but what's driving this?
Well, what we see is a combination of factors. There certainly is a lot of optimism regarding tax cuts, not necessarily tax reforms. You got to delineate that. And what we're seeing is sort of a sugar high where many investors are just hoping that a lower corporate tax rate and lower tax rates on the wealthy will fall to their bottom line. And I think that's what you're seeing priced into the market. These market highs are as rich by some measures, Bob Shiller, who's the Nobel laureate economist, has said since 1929. The only good news is they're not as levered.
Now, the market has just been going up and up and up for many years now. Are there fears in your crowd that this could be a bubble, that it could be about to have a correction?
I think there is a lot of concern that there is volatility in the future, that there could be a lot of potholes in the legislative process, which we've already seen. It's very inconsistent. You heard a good summary just about, you know, the back and forth on repeal, replace on healthcare. Tax policy is also sort of already morphed from reform, which is revenue neutral, into these cuts, which is a sugar high and not getting on us a fiscal nutritious place going forward, and adding to the deficit, which would raise interest rates down the road and undermine financial markets. So financial markets are at risk right now, and they are also very accustomed to very easy monetary policy. This has been a global phenomenon where, you know, sort of the central banks have been propping up economies around the world, but we've now got some stamina. We're actually seeing some self-feeding momentum, and they don't have to sort of spike the punch bowl anymore. They're actually adding a little fruit punch. And the question is, how much fruit punch do they water down that punch bowl with to avoid a hangover? Because that could actually affect financial markets if they water it down too quickly, very rapidly.
And this rally has been going on for a long time at this point.
Absolutely. And what you saw was, I mean, I remember when the markets hit the NASDAQ, I think it was hit, or the S&P hit 666, that sign of the devil, it was awful, back in 2009, and then finally came back. But it really was central banks providing easy money and companies being able to restructure their debt and get back on their solid footing. Some of it was very good profits, but it hasn't really fallen down to the bottom line of wages. We're still seeing an economy that is doing well, is generating jobs, but not as much wage growth as we'd like to see. And of course, as wage share increases, that is what would be a healthier stage of the economy, but it would be a more difficult phase for markets as well.
Now, you've been talking about how some of this market rally is due to the expectation about tax cuts. The Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, told Politico in a podcast out today that not passing the Republican tax bill would cause the market to plummet. Let's listen.
I think to the extent we get the tax deal done, the stock market will go up higher. But there's no question in my mind, if we don't get it done, you're going to see a reversal of a significant amount of these gains.
Diane, is there truth to that?
I think there is truth to that because the markets are very much pricing in. They've overpriced in a tax cut and reform and the efficiencies we get from that. So we're risky, even if they fall short on what they deliver on legislation, that these markets are not, you know, they're pricing in too much optimism on that.
What other concerns are there in the market right now besides what's happening in Washington? We know the Party Congress is going on in China today. Over
yes.
the last few years, people have been worried about China at different times. Are there other factors that you're watching?
There's a lot of factors I'm watching. I'm not sure that the markets are watching them as closely as they should. One is NAFTA, whether or not trade agreements get pushed through and what that means for repercussions for our companies abroad, but also and in the U.S. But more importantly, what's going to happen with our own Federal Reserve? We could see as many as 6 seats of the 7 Board of Governors, including the chair and vice chair, turn over. We're going to see an announcement on the chair and who's going to replace Janet Yellen, or is she going to stay on, hopefully in the next week or so. That keeps getting put off. The more it's put put off, the more uncertainty we have. But it's at a time when we also could see the central bank shift towards raising rates more aggressively and bringing on leadership that would be more inclined to raise rates more aggressively. That's something that financial markets have not priced in at all.
You think if it's somebody other than Janet Yellen that gets picked by President Trump to lead the Fed, that that person could try to raise rates faster?
I think Jay Powell, who's currently on the Fed with Janet Yellen, wouldn't do that, and he's on the list as well. He's more of a continuity type player, although he may be forced to raise rates more rapidly given the economy and how it's unfolding. And its resilience, which is good. It's an affirmation of the strength in the economy. But the bottom line is we're talking about a lot of people who, although they are much more in favor of deregulation, something the market likes in the financial sector, they want to raise rates a lot more rapidly. So it's no free lunch for the financial markets.
That's Diane Swonk, founder of DS Economics in Chicago. Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
A 2015 Pew Research Center poll found the number of multiracial Americans growing at three times the rate of the general population. So, what might they face? Julie Lithcott-Hames, a former dean at her alma mater, Stanford, has some thoughts. She wrote the wildly popular How to Raise an Adult about overprotective parents. Much of her new book is about how her own parents, her mother white, her father black, didn't protect her, and how much she wants to protect her own children after her marriage to a white man. Julie grew up in an all-white town in Wisconsin where someone scrawled the N-word on her locker, where at a black cotillion she first realized those with black mothers knew how to handle their hair. In college, she actually wrote the paper that helped clear the way for biracial adoption, which was discouraged until recently. But it took her a while to love her own biracial self. Her new book is Real American and Julie Lithcott-Hames. Part of resolving this was deciding how you wanted to identify yourself.
My identity is solidly black, with biracial as a factual component of it. I finally located a self I could love within blackness. Biracial was an important term for me when it first came out in the late 80s, because previously we hadn't known what to call people like me. It finally was a way to stop ignoring my white mother. But as I say in the book, it was a fleeting lover. I think what I was really hungering for was simply to find a sense of belonging within the black community. And when I found it, it was probably one of the greatest embraces I've ever felt.
Yeah. As you write in the very beginning of the book, I am the woolly-haired, medium brown-skinned offspring typical when blacks and whites have sex, which was considered illegal in 17 of the 50 United States in 1966. Your parents went ahead and got married anyway in Nigeria in 1967. It's hard to remember what a scandal that might have been.
It was a scandal.
But you become this girl in the 70s growing up who, you know, you put your streamers in your bike on the 4th of July, and your mother seems to be so open to your blackness. But yeah. What was the disconnect there?
The conventional wisdom at the time was mixed race, biracial children need to be raised with a black identity because the world will see them as black, America will treat them as black, and they need to know that and be black and proud. So my parents did a lot of speaking to that. But they chose to raise me in white towns, which meant I didn't have peers, I didn't have teachers, I didn't have mentors, I didn't see people like me in my town, in my school. And so there was a hollowness to the you are black declaration my parents made. And I was a bit bewildered, particularly to hear my white mother say this. I could see that it was this deliberate effort she was making. And she wasn't just play acting. She had lived in West Africa. She cared deeply about Africans. She cared about African Americans when my folks moved here in 69. She had a consciousness around the diaspora and Pan-African issues that most white folks in America didn't then have. And yet, even though she'd read all the studies about black children need black dolls to be healthy psychologically, she did that, but didn't go the much more necessary steps further, which would have included towns with a critical mass of black folks, schools with a critical mass. So that aspect of my upbringing was really severely lacking.
Well, and the microaggressions and the macro. You know, you had a girlfriend, you're overplaying at her house, and she comes and says to you, hey, my sister was visiting when you guys first moved here. She saw your dad riding a lawnmower, and she said, oh, look, they have a black gardener.
And yeah, and he'd just stepped down from being Assistant Surgeon General for President Jimmy Carter.
Or on another occasion, you're swimming in the neighborhood pool. Mm. How? What fun. And somebody's father comes?
Yeah. When I was about 7, living in Rockland County, New York, I was in the above-ground swimming pool at a friend's house and with a bunch of other kids. And apparently, one kid's father got wind of the fact that I was in the pool polluting it with my blackness. And he came to the door and said he wanted to bring his child home. My friend's mother, who stood at the door, apparently gave him quite a tongue-lashing, which I'm grateful for, even though I was never there to observe it. But the father was undeterred. He came and rescued his boy from the pool that had been polluted by the presence of little old black me.
Yeah. Look, at one point you ask as a child, why'd you move into this all-white town?
Well— you know, I don't actually say it. I wished I'd said, why'd you move me to this all-black town?
Right. It's a thought bubble. Right.
And I couldn't ask it, is the thing. So I adored my daddy. He was smart and accomplished and influential and loved me. And so when he saw this photo of a friend had taken of me with this boy who I had a crush on, this white boy in my high school, which was filled with white people, my daddy says, white boys will be your friend, but they'll never date you. And I couldn't say to him then, why the heck did you move me here? Don't I deserve to be loved, Daddy? Why did you make this choice?
Talk about when things started to change. I mean, there's so much here, so I'm going to take you through your high school and college years. People don't think you belong in Stanford. I mean, there's a white professor that's a good friend of yours. He says, oh, you're a twofer, a woman and a black. In other words, the insult that you were just filling quotas, two of them.
When I got into Harvard Law School, yeah.
These people betraying you in some ways. You thought yeah. they were your friends. But take us to the point where it starts to change for you. Because you yourself were sort of embarrassed about your blackness, if I've kind of got that right.
Sure. You know, so I'm, by now in the story, I'm a dean at Stanford University. I'm the dean of freshmen. I'm the associate vice provost for undergraduate education. That's an important role. An executive coach has been brought in to work with 5 or 6 of us on this same team. We're not getting along well with each other, and the coach is there to help us improve our team dynamic. And when she was able to deliver my 360-degree feedback, the feedback kind of rang out like this. Too loud, too pushy, too aggressive, too emotional, too impulsive, too angry. And I thought, are you freaking kidding me? This is the dictionary definition of the angry black woman. I am being stereotyped as I'm being told how to improve my behavior. And my lovely executive coach, who was a white Buddhist Aikido master, she looked at me and smiled and she said, how's that working for you? And I looked at her. And I said, not very well. She nodded and smiled. She said, what if you got a handle on when the feelings were coming so you could decide, do I want to respond or not? If I do want to respond, how do I want to respond? What I learned as I began to notice the feelings as they were coming up, to be able to stop them and interrogate them, I began to realize they come when I'm feeling disregarded, disrespected, dissed, you know, and that for me is rooted in this fear that this comment this other person is making is like 1, 2, 3, 5 steps away from them calling me the N-word. Mm. Now, I'm not saying they wanted to call me the N-word. I'm saying the psychological corrosiveness of the microaggressions from my childhood into my adulthood had made me fear that that was possible again.
There was also a part of you that recognized, yeah, I am an angry black woman. There's things to be angry at. For instance, yeah. There's that meeting where a white woman, you're wearing your hair naturally. For so many years, you'd straighten it with a curling iron. You're wearing your hair naturally. And she starts touching it.
She puts her hands on it and starts to toss it like a salad or like bounce it like a beach ball. And I back away and I look at her fiercely in the eye and I say, you can't do this. This is a thing that white women do to black women. You can't do this. Don't pet me. Yeah. And the other women, I'm appealing with my eyes to a woman I thought knew better to say, please help me. Please help me. Do not make me have to fight this alone. Don't make me out to be the crazy one here, folks.
Yeah. Well, you come to the point where you realize you're not reacting enough to the real world that your children are growing up in. you question, you know, what have I done? Have I done the same thing, marrying what sounds like this wonderful white man? Yeah. What's your answer?
I'm trying to build in them the kind of self-love around their existence as people of color that I lacked. I'm trying to talk really frequently and openly about the various issues we contend with as people of color. You know, my daughter is light enough that she's got her arm around her brother. She gets these kinds of questions. Who's that guy? Are you dating him? Because they don't match skin tone. Mm-hmm. Or I come to pick her up in an event. Who's that lady? She's my mother. She's your mother? So she's constantly told she doesn't match her own family. And boy, that happened to me too with my white mom. And so I hope I've created in them a greater consciousness than I had. I hope I've given them a foundation of love so they love themselves. So that when the, you know, what hits the fan, if it does, I'm not saying it will, but it might, that they know they have someone to turn to, their mom, that they know they can also turn to their dad, who's an incredibly woke white man, and fundamentally be embraced, be listened to, be believed, and then supported, and then reinforced with strength to get back out there into America.
You have a message that you deliver close to the end of the book. Okay. I wonder if you could just read that.
I am drawn like a magnet to the little fuzzy-headed brown-skinned kids and with white parents whom I see in restaurants, in airports, in malls. My body wants to go near. My soul wants to be a friend to a child who might be feeling lost on an island. Instead, I smile deeply at the children and at the parent. If the parent doesn't get why I'm smiling, I hope he or she will think, why is that woman smiling at me? What is she saying with that smile? I'm saying, please read up on this. Please have black friends. Please don't make the mistakes my parents made. Please build some belonging to community. Please give this kid a chance to develop a healthy self. If the hair is done right, I compliment the parent.
Julie Lithcott-Hames, her new book, Real American, is about growing up black and biracial. Julie, thank you so much.
Robin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The death toll in the Northern California fires has risen to at least 42. It's been about a week and a half since the fires began. Weather conditions are now improving. Some rain is on the way, and firefighters continue to make progress. Many evacuees are returning home, and the region is turning toward recovery. FEMA Administrator Brock Long was there yesterday to survey damage and encourage residents to apply for assistance if needed. Let's check in now with KQED's Dan Brecke in San Francisco. Dan, what is the latest on the fires? How many are still burning?
Well, they're pretty much all still burning, and some of these things are going to keep burning and smoldering until there's a really good soaking rain. But so what we're looking at is how contained they are. And the news is really good on that front. The biggest, most devastating fire that people have heard about, called the Tubbs Fire, which burned through parts of Santa Rosa, is more than 90% contained this morning. And those containment numbers are going up everywhere. But the head of CAL FIRE, the agency that's in charge of the response for many of the state's fires, appeared in Napa yesterday, one of the communities that's been affected. And he was emphasizing that, you know, we're really not done with the fire season. We've got another bout of hot weather coming. And anyway, here's what he had to say to the folks in Napa yesterday.
Right behind that will be wind, and we're looking at Santa Ana winds in Southern California in the coming weeks. And so our eye is on the ball. Our eye is on the ball for the long haul.
And to emphasize what he's saying there, I mean, the state which already has a massive number of firefighters coming in from other states, is asking for further assistance. And when he's speaking of Santa Ana winds, weather forecasters are talking about the potential for record heat in Southern California, which is one of the primary ingredients to, high fire danger.
Now, we've heard about the number of dead, at least 42 at this point. There are also dozens of people who are still reported as missing. What kind of efforts are going on to find them?
Well, there's an intensive law enforcement investigative effort. They've had detectives working on this from the beginning, and I think the difference is the scale of it. But this list has been whittled down from there have been as many as 1,800 people reported missing. So now we're under 100, and there are about 40 they believe in Sonoma County itself. So, you know, this involves classic detective work, but it also involves, you know, flying over suspected places where people may be with drones and then a site search. People have been found that way. The other thing that is actually very interesting to see, the officials are not releasing the names of who they're still looking for. But you see this online. On Facebook, for instance, there are groups that have been started to assist with the search.
That's Dan Brecke of KQED in San Francisco, watching the fires that have been going on in Northern California. And, of course, a lot of people now for the first time being able to go back and see what's left of their property. Thousands of homes and businesses destroyed. Dan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It's Here and Now, and we want to take a moment now to note the passing of Daphne Caruana Galizia, the 53-year-old journalist called the anti-corruption warrior, assassinated this week in a targeted car bombing on the island of Malta. The opposition leader there said her murder represented the collapse of democracy and freedom of expression. The Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, a frequent subject of her investigations, said nobody can justify this barbaric act. Robert Mahoney is Deputy Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, the nonprofit Press Freedom Group. He joins us now. And Robert, tell us about Daphne Galizia.
Well, she was a one-woman warrior, as you just said. And she made it her life's work as a journalist to root out corruption and expose wrongdoing on the island of Malta. And all the people that were the target of her investigations, she knew. And so she made lots of enemies. But she was a wonderful journalist, a very vibrant person, and someone who really was unique in that island society.
Is anyone taking responsibility? And remind us, you know, why she was working so hard to root out corruption.
Well, no one's taken responsibility, as far as we know, for this targeted assassination. Mm. And, you know, Malta is a country which has been plagued by corruption because it has weak institutions of state. And so what happens in this situation is that journalists often step in to fill in the gap. And she didn't have the protections that journalists, say, in the United States would have.
Well, and you say that. We have been speaking with journalists recently who have had to have armed protection because of the, you know, hostilities during the presidential campaign, for instance. What is the sense of the safety of journalists today?
You know, there's never really been in the history of the Committee to Protect Journalists a more dangerous time to be a journalist. There are more journalists being killed around the world, more journalists being jailed around the world for their work than at any time in the 36-year history of this organization. And so the kind of work that Daphne was doing is very dangerous. And unless you have the protections of the rule of law and of the courts, then you're very exposed.
Yeah. Robert Mahoney, Deputy Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, on the death of Daphne Caruana Galizia in Malta. Robert, thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, now a story we urge you to take a couple minutes with about a tragedy averted. July 8th was just another day in Panama City Beach, Florida. Families enjoying the beach, strangers to other families, but in a matter of minutes, inextricably, physically linked. Erica Lance from WBUR's podcast Kind World explains.
I like going to the beach. We can find sand dollars,
stingrays, jellyfish,
and seashells and crabs.
On a warm summer day, 11-year-old Noah and 8-year-old Stephen played in the water while their mom watched. It was just the sort of day Roberta Ursary dreamed of. A few months before, Roberta had been a correctional officer in Georgia, but they came here whenever they could, to the Florida sand and sun. When Roberta's dad died, she thought, why not live in the place you love? So she packed up her mom, her husband, her 2 girls and 2 boys, and they all moved to Panama City, Florida.
Our little piece of heaven down here.
One day in July, Roberta was scanning the horizon from her beach chair when she realized she couldn't see Stephen and Noah.
Where's the boys? So I went to looking up and down the beach, and I seen them in the water. All I heard was them screaming for help.
We was trying to ride the waves to get to shore, but the riptide kept on pulling us back.
And it was strong.
Me and Noah was going to get drowned.
A woman was already with the boys, but when she and her wife tried to save them, she got stuck too. Roberta dropped her phone and ran into the water as some men on shore warned her it was too dangerous.
And I said, I don't care. I said, those are my kids. I'm going out there. And so I started swimming out. The boys were on their stomachs holding on to their boogie boards. They were just crying and begging me to get them out of there. And I told them, I said, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. Mommy's going to get you. And I could feel the suction up underneath. There was waves coming over on top of us, knocking me under.
She pulled. She pushed. She tried everything she could think of to get her sons out of the rip current that was dragging them out to sea.
And it was not working.
One by one, Roberta's other family members saw what was happening and rushed out to help.
Our uncle came in after Noah. Our granny swam over. Our dad swam over.
So he ends up stuck.
Now 10 people were caught in the water, including most of Roberta's family. All she could think was they were all about to die. Meanwhile, down the beach, Jessica Simmons and her husband Derek noticed the police lights.
People still standing on the beach are very unsure of what they want to do, just staring.
Then Derek thought of something he'd seen on TV, how ants link their bodies together into bridges so they can cross water.
So that's when my husband started yelling, grab arms, let's grab arms.
He and about 5 other people held hands and made a human chain.
These people just started following in. I mean, they just started running into the water, just linking together.
Derek's mom and nieces joined. Locals and tourists from all over the world jumped in. Some couldn't speak English, some couldn't swim, but the chain grew longer and longer.
Each person trusted each other to make sure they came out of that water alive.
We don't know how many joined, but Derek and Jessica think close to 70 people linked arms that day. Finally, they were just 15 feet from Roberta and her family.
The guy on the very end, he was screaming. He had his arm out as far as he could reach it. And he was like, grab my arm, grab my arm. And I could hear the father going, we can't reach you.
So Jessica took a chance. She swam out with her boogie board, past the chain, and all the way to the group that was stranded.
And that's when I realized how bad it was.
Roberta's 27-year-old nephew held on to his grandmother, who was having a heart attack in the water.
And he was drowning himself to keep her above. And she's like, just let me be, save yourself. And then she'd go underwater and he'd bring her back up. He's like, Grandma, Grandma, you gotta stay with me. You gotta keep talking to me.
Roberta was on her back, struggling to stay alive.
I was just so exhausted that I couldn't even keep my eyes open.
She said, yeah, just save my boys. Don't worry about me. It was haunting because I felt like she was going to just give up any minute. And she said, I can't do it anymore. Just let me go. And I looked at her with all seriousness, I guess because my adrenaline was rushed. And I said, no, hon, that's not going to happen today. So I gave her the boogie board.
Roberta and little Steven got on it.
And I said, I need you to kick as hard as you can. Kick, kick, kick. And so I grabbed the string on the boogie board and started pulling it towards the human chain as she was kicking.
Somehow she made it and handed off the rope.
The guy on the end starts yelling, pull. And then you could hear about five people down. Another guy says, pull.
Pull. Pull. It almost sounded like a choir.
Pull. Pull. Pull.
And you could hear it over that ocean.
Just echo back all the way to the beach.
All of them moved toward shore, pulling Roberta and her son to safety, then back for the next trip. Derek and Jessica swam back and forth, bringing people one by one to the human chain. Somehow, it was working.
I can remember having the grandmother in the water, and she was so out of it that she thought that I was the nephew. And I just looked at her like she was my grandmother. At that moment, I didn't feel like they were strangers anymore.
Derek thought they'd save maybe two people that day, but by the end, all 10 were safe on the sand. Even Roberta's mother made it, though she's still recovering from her heart attack. As everyone went their separate ways, Roberta met with Jessica, the woman who'd saved her sons.
And I just grabbed a hold of her and hugged her and told her, thank you.
Words couldn't say all that she was feeling, but with that hug, they became family. They still talk almost every day.
I told her she's kind of stuck with us.
The names of most of the people in that human chain are a mystery. But for Derek, those people are a hope for the future.
There's just a lot of hate in this world. And that day, for that hour, we were humans.
Humans who took a chance, held hands, and ventured together into the sea. For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lance.
U.S.-backed Kurdish forces removed landmines and cleared main roads in the Syrian city of Raqqa today. They announced yesterday that the city had been retaken from ISIS, which has held it for the last 3 years. It was their de facto capital. Joining us now is the BBC's Lena Sinjab. She's in Beirut, Lebanon. And Lena, what is the view there of what looks like a big defeat for ISIS in the city of Raqqa?
Well, this is definitely a big, big victory for the powers that are trying to fight terrorism in both Iraq and Syria. Raqqa was once called the capital of the caliphate, and that was a very symbolic location for the group. And this defeat is really big for them. But, you know, for people here in the region who are used to the, destabled situation in the region, they're still thinking that, okay, there are still pockets in Iraq. There is still a big fight to go in Deir ez-Zor, which Russia and the Syrian government are fighting IS there. So the battle against the group is not over yet. It's a big blow for them in Raqqa, but their influence, the trouble that they can cause, the threat they can cause, whether in the region or beyond, is still likely to happen.
But are they likely to retake other cities to actually have a base for their caliphate, or is that the end of ISIS controlling cities?
I think that's by all means, everyone is looking and following up the developments of the fight against IS. I can tell that this is the end of them taking up territories and claiming that they are in control of a city or a town. I mean, we still have to wait and see the battle for Deir ez-Zor, how it will unfold. But as we can also follow with the, this battle, it's also nearing its end. But the question here, especially for people in the Middle East, is that, is the ideology over? IS started, the group started in 2003 in Iraq, and then in 2014, they've announced their presence in Syria. So within 10 years, they've appeared again under different name and different shape. So, there are so many questions about these ideologies and these kind of groups, how they are going to, if and how and when they will appear again.
What does the fall of Raqqa mean for President Assad in Syria?
Well, President Assad for sure cannot claim victory for Raqqa or take any credit for that battle because it wasn't handled by his own forces or his own allies. In fact, it was handled by forces that he always called as enemies, you know, U.S.-backed forces, the Kurdish Democratic Forces, supported by the U.S., by the air or by weapons. They are the ones who managed to liberate Raqqa from IS. However, he will definitely make use of this liberation in the fight against terrorism. Let's not forget that President Assad 7 years ago, 6 years ago, 5 years ago, was called by the world as the one who was like destroying Syria, killing civilians, and you know, cracking down on peaceful protesters. But he turned the whole game into a fight against terrorism, and now he is just a partner with the world in the fight against IS.
We were speaking yesterday with Mike Giglio, a reporter with BuzzFeed, who said it was no coincidence that ISIS losing Raqqa to these Kurdish forces you're talking about and the Iraqi military going after the Kurds in Kirkuk in Iraq was happening at the same time. Is that the view?
Well, there are so many questions raised here among, you know, analysts and people following up the story in the Middle East that all of a sudden, after the Kurds being partners with the U.S., supported by the world and supported by the U.S., all of a sudden the Iraqi forces are coming in and taking back Kirkuk. And it's definitely at the same time coinciding with them, therefore the other forces are liberating Raqqa and fighting against IS. So it is a big question for them and definitely a change in the geopolitics in the region.
How is President Trump's decision on the Iran deal to not recertify the Iran deal to allow Congress to decide whether to reimpose sanctions? How is that being received in the region? And what does it mean for all of the things we've been talking about, if anything?
This is a very important issue. The whole world is looking at the American policies, especially with President Trump, but also with some speculations because they're not sure when he says something, he will actually do it. But you can still feel the changes on the ground. You know, Iran and Hezbollah are almost in control of Syria. They're not on the same page with Russia, although they're supporting the regime. Russia has its own interests. Iran has several different interests. There is Israel also on the ground too. So there is sort of you know, bubbling situation inside. You don't know when it will explode or how it will explode. But certainly everyone is watching. It's a time game. Your ally today could be your enemy tomorrow, but you need to make use of the current situation to defend your own interest. And that's certainly the case for Iran and Hezbollah and the Shia militia who are in control on the ground in Syria and in Iraq.
That's the BBC's Lina Sinjab joining us from Beirut, Lebanon. Lina, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was lovely talking to you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.